I look forward to sharing this talk with you and for the conversation to follow. The title is How to Avoid Being Unhappy, Vices That Undermine Human Flourishing. As you can tell from the title, this talk has a practical aim. The aim is to help us learn how to avoid being unhappy. That may seem a bit unambitious. We shouldn't be satisfied with merely avoiding unhappiness. We won't achieve happiness by backing into it or by chance. We should aim for happiness. This talk serves this greater aim by targeting common obstacles to happiness. The focus of this talk will be obstacles to happiness called vices. The avoidance of vices helps us to avoid unhappiness. Aristotle writes in the second book of his Nicomachean Ethics that the purpose of his study is to help his listeners or readers become good. I hope this talk serves the same purpose. To begin, I'm going to say something about happiness and unhappiness. I'll then say what a vice is and how it may undermine human flourishing. I'll introduce a class of vices that St. Thomas Aquinas, following the long line of Christian reflection, calls the capital vices. I'll then turn to three specific capital vices that will receive the bulk of this talk's attention. What I'll say comes mainly from Aristotle and Aquinas. In particular, the central text underlying the bulk of this talk is Aquinas' disputed questions on evil. I've also benefited from many scholars of Aquinas on vices, and especially Robert Krushwitz and Rebecca Canondike de Young, whose short book, Glittering Vices, has provided me with many insights into the vices and has served my students well as we've studied them together. The Greek philosopher Aristotle claims in his Nicomachean Ethics that all human beings desire happiness and that they desire everything else for happiness. My experience with students lends support to this view. I typically start my ethics course with a question about why students are in the class. One typical answer is, because the university requires it. And so I ask them, why do you submit to this requirement? And they say, well, I want a degree from the University of Mary. And I say, well, why do you want that? And they say, well, I want a job. And they say, well, why do you want a job? Or I say to them, why do you want a job? And they say, well, I want to provide for myself. I want to provide for a family. I say, okay, why do you want to do that? And then they start to get a little puzzled. And they start to say, well, I want a good life. I want to be happy. Or something to that effect. And then I say, okay, why do you want that? And now they're really flummoxed. And they say something like, I just want it. And that's, in a way, what Aristotle has in mind here. Their pursuit, these students, of things is ordered ultimately to their happiness, even if they haven't really reflected on it that much up to that point. Aristotle thinks that everyone agrees, in general, that happiness is living well or having a good life. But there's much disagreement about what happiness or having a good life consists in. Some held it to be a life of pleasure and enjoyment, others a life in pursuit of wealth or power, and still others hold it to be a life in pursuit of honor. While Aristotle thinks these things have a place in a good life, Aristotle's own view is that the correct answer to the question about human happiness depends on what makes for a good human life. And this depends on what constitutes and promotes the objective flourishing of human beings. He claims that human beings flourish when they perform their characteristic activity well. A characteristic activity of a thing is an activity that characterizes the kind of thing it is. For example, playing the guitar is the characteristic activity of a guitar player. To play the guitar well is to flourish or to be good as a guitar player. What is the characteristic activity of the human being? Aristotle claims that it's the activity of using our reason, which is what makes us distinct from the other animals. We flourish as human beings when we use our reason well. Using our reason well includes understanding things, making good choices, and fostering reasonable emotional responses regarding the situations and people we encounter and the actions we pursue. Aristotle calls these activities in accord with right reason, where right reason judges what conduces to human flourishing. Aristotle calls the habits of activity in accord with right reason virtues. A virtue is intellectual when it involves good habits of the intellect or the mind. A virtue is moral when it involves good habits of choosing and feeling. These habits are tendencies, and a bit like skills. They make us able to do reasonable things reliably, easily, and with pleasure, or at least without pain. Aristotle claims that a good life is one characterized by such virtuous activity, and that this will be done with friends. Friends are vital for our flourishing because we're social animals who need each other for good lives. Aristotle's basic notion of friendship is that it's a relationship characterized by mutual goodwill, of which both parties are aware, that is based on some likeness between them. The fullest and most complete kind of friends are those we care about for their own sake, and not merely because they are pleasant or useful to us. I'll call these good friends. So if we want to summarize Aristotle's view of happiness, or of living a good life, it is that happiness is a life of virtuous activity with good friends. Aquinas shares this view, but he thinks that virtuous activity with friends in this life alone cannot perfectly satisfy us. We will still have trouble and face disappointment and death here. There will always be some things lacking even the best of lives here. If we are to be perfectly fulfilled, he says, we must enjoy eternal and perfect virtuous activity with friends, where God is the first and best friend that we know and love forever. Here's a brief summary of what I've said. Happiness goes beyond pleasure or the mere satisfaction of desires, although it involves such things. It is a living of a life that befits and fulfills our nature as rational and social beings. The slogan for happiness is virtuous activity with friends. And for Aquinas, we can only have happiness imperfectly in this life, but perfectly with eternal friendship with God. Because this is a talk focused on vice, I'm going to assume that something like Aristotle and Aquinas' view is correct. I'm going to assume that acting reasonably and developing virtue is essential for happiness. I'm also going to assume that having good friendships is essential for happiness. These are significant assumptions, and I don't claim to have argued for them. We can talk more of them in the Q&A or after the talk if you'd like. These assumptions have implications for unhappiness. I will be unhappy if I fail to use my reason well in my thoughts and actions, and if I fail to become the kind of person that can be a good friend. If I ignore using my reason well, I'll make poor choices and be subject to the psychological disintegration that follows from them over time. I'll experience conflicts between my mind and desires, and if I always resolve those in favor of my desires without subjecting them to reason scrutiny, I'll weaken my judgment and make even poor choices. I will be unhappy if I make myself incapable of being a good friend who can care about others for their own sake. If I only care about what is pleasant to me or useful to me, I'll fail to develop these friendships. Not only will this leave me lonely, but I'll miss out on some of the benefits of such friends, which includes their help in knowing my strengths and weaknesses, their advice in times of difficult decision-making, their correction of me when I make bad choices, their encouragement of me to keep my focus on my goals, their sharing in my sorrows, and their rejoicing with me in my triumphs. What has this to do with vice? Whereas virtues are good habits that conduce to human flourishing, vices are bad habits of thinking, choosing, and feeling that undermine human flourishing. Vices are formed by repeated bad choices, such as choosing something wrong, failing to do what is right, failing to correct some unreasonable emotional response, and so on. Vice makes it easier for us to make bad choices and to respond poorly to situations, and so undermine our own good and the good of others. The vices I'll focus on involve patterns of emotional responses that are bad for us and others. I'll also focus on the ways they undermine friendship. If being happy requires friendship and vices are threats to friendship, then vices are also threats to being happy. What are capital vices? The word capital comes from the Latin caput, which means head. Head in this sense does not refer to the head of the body or the head of an organization, but instead to the head or source of something, such as the head of a river. These vices are sources of other sins. In the realm of ethics, Aquinas uses the term sin to refer to defective, voluntary acts that fail to promote human flourishing, rather than to an exclusively theological sense that some may associate with the word sin. Capital sins are sources of other sins by giving the reason why those other sins are committed. For example, if a greedy person lies in order to get money that's not due them, then the person's greed, which is his excessive desire for money, is the source of or the reason he chooses to lie. The lie in this case is called an offspring of greed. Aquinas identifies 7 capital vices: vainglory, spiritual apathy, envy, wrath, greed, gluttony, and lust. He identifies these 7 because they involve goods we naturally desire and common ways we respond to obstacles to our desires. I'll discuss 3 different vices. The first vice, vainglory, is a bad habit that involves an unreasonable pursuit of something we see as good. The second vice, spiritual apathy, or sloth, is a bad habit that involves an unreasonable withdrawal from something that is good for us. The third vice, envy, is a bad habit that involves an unreasonable withdrawal from willing what is good for another person. I'll focus on the bad acts and feelings these vices dispose us, but coming to understand these vices better, you'll come to know enemies to happiness and some ways to avoid them, which is a key step towards being happy. The first vice I'll address is vainglory. What is it? Vainglory is a vice, or is a vain or unreasonable desire for one's own glory. What is glory? Glory is the manifestation or revelation of one's goodness, which leads to praise. The glory, or the one who seeks glory, seeks for his goodness to be made known, recognized, and praised, whether that is by many, a few, or even himself. We have a natural desire to be known and loved that often underlies our desire for glory. Aquinas argues that the desire for glory can be good when it is desired instrumentally or as an instrumental good. An instrumental good is desired because it's useful for something else. Aquinas holds that we should only desire glory when it's useful for our flourishing or the good of another. It should not be desired simply for its own sake or merely because it's pleasant. He says there are 3 good reasons to desire glory. They are when one's own glory is useful for first revealing God's glory. It's fitting for a person's goodness to reveal God's goodness because God is the primary cause or source of the person's goodness. In this case, the desire for glory is motivated by love for another. That is also true of the second good reason for desiring glory that Aquinas mentions. It's also good to desire glory when it serves a neighbor's good. Sometimes it's very good for another person to see one's own goodness. The piano teacher reveals her excellence at playing so that her student can imitate her and become good at piano. The coach may perform some action well so that his players can see how to do it. You might make known something good about yourself to another because you wish to encourage that person to persevere in seeking to become good in the same way as you. In these ways, we seek glory out of love or goodwill for another, for your neighbor. The third reason to desire glory is when it serves one's own good. We sometimes desire that our goodness be known and praised because it's useful for us to know we are on the right track, that we are doing well. Praise helps confirm us in the pursuit of our goals. It can be a source of encouragement to persist in the good things we're doing. For example, praise from your teacher on a paper helps you to make progress as a writer. Praise from your coach helps you to make progress as an athlete. In these examples, the persons want praise because the praise serves their own good and helps them to grow. These are the 3 ways we can rightly desire glory for Aquinas. Now let's look at how we desire it wrongly. Vainglory is when we seek glory vainly. Aquinas calls vain, things that are false, that easily pass away, or that fail to attain their due purpose. Accordingly, Aquinas distinguishes 3 ways of vainly seeking glory according to these 3 notions of the word vain. So, the first is to seek glory for something false. For example, I stretch the truth to make myself look better. I take credit for something good that's not my own work. I boast that I caught a fish this big, and every time I tell the tale, the fish gets bigger. The second kind of glory, or vainglory, is to seek glory for something that easily passes away. For example, I seek glory for my clothes, car, or physical appearance. I want you to think I'm a great person and worthy of praise because of something I have that's transitory or easily passes away. The third kind of vainglory is to seek glory in a way that's not ordered to our proper end. Our proper end is true happiness. Virtuous activity with friends, if Aquinas and Aristotle are right. But in this third case, I desire that others know about my goodness not for God's glory, not for my neighbor's good, and not for my own good. I simply want the glory for its own sake and wrongly think having that glory will fulfill me and make me truly happy. Aquinas' example is that of a person who desires that others recognize how knowledgeable he is, simply for its own sake. But Aquinas claims that while knowledge is essential to human fulfillment, having others recognize one's knowledge is not. In the case, the person has unreasonably treated glory as the source of human happiness, but the praise of others is not what our fulfillment consists in, and so this desire is vain in the last sense. What are some bad effects of vainglory? Taking glory in something false is seeking undeserved praise. It's a kind of hypocrisy. We're annoyed when people wear a mask and pretend to be better than they are. This hinders being good friends because you're giving a false image of yourself. It's hard to be friends with a phony. Once the phony is found out, they lose the praise they receive. Taking glory in what easily passes away is to seek more credit than is deserved. We're annoyed when a person makes a big deal of himself because he has something shiny, new, or expensive, but which isn't something of enduring value. We recognize that there is a mismatch between the praise being sought and the thing that is the basis for the praise. It's hard to be good friends with someone who is shallow, who cares too much about being highly praised for things that don't warrant it. Third, people who live for praise are seeking to fulfill what is lacking in themselves with something unsuitable to the task. Glory does not fulfill us by itself. It won't fulfill our deepest longings to be known and loved. A person who lives for praise will be at the mercy of others' opinions. He would also seek friendships for the praise his friends might give him. But this cannot be the basis for a truly good friendship, which requires love for the other for his own sake. An ultimate quest for glory will poison our motivations. What are some offspring of vainglory? Recall that offspring are defective acts or emotions that have as their source the capital vice or sin. These offspring are typical, but there can be many others. The first kind of offspring are acts by which we seek to make known our goodness directly. We can do so by words and deeds. With words, we do so by boasting. The boaster announces, "I got the highest grade in the class." We can also show our goodness through deeds, which Aquinas calls audacity for novelties. This would be an action I do that I think will surprise and impress people and make them praise me. YouTube is filled with videos of such acts. Finally, we can also seek praise for deeds we haven't done, which Aquinas calls hypocrisy. The hypocrite's one who seeks praise for good deeds he hasn't really performed. The second kind of offspring are acts by which we seek to make known our goodness indirectly, by trying to show that we're not inferior to others. And here are three examples Aquinas gives. I'm obstinate when I refuse to believe another person because I don't want to admit that I'm wrong and that they are superior to me in belief. I'm contentious if I refuse to acknowledge when another person has won an argument or spoken more convincingly than me. Finally, I'm disobedient when I refuse to obey a proper authority because I don't want to admit the authority is my superior. Got a theme song. When vainglorious, all of these are motivated by a desire to protect our image. How can we avoid vainglory or work against it? Rebecca de Young recommends two disciplines following the wisdom of the Christian monastic tradition. The first is to practice silence. One of the easiest ways to draw attention to ourselves is with words. If we check our speech, we can begin to recognize and evaluate our tendencies to draw attention to ourselves. Once we notice these tendencies, we can evaluate whether they are reasonable or not. If I practice silence, I may realize that my desire to share a story about my adventures after hearing another friend tell his story, may come from a desire to one-up my friend, or to at least try not to appear inferior to that friend. The second remedy is to seek solitude and to avoid an audience, even if that audience is yourself. Don't check yourself out in every mirror. Take a break from social media and posting about yourself. By intentionally taking a break from such things, we can see whether our desire for the praise of others stems from good reasons or from vain reasons. Silence and solitude are two remedies to vainglory. The next vice we'll look at is spiritual apathy, which is also called sloth. Apathy means a lack of love or concern. Spiritual apathy involves a lack of love or concern for a spiritual good. Aquinas defines spiritual apathy as a habit of sadness or boredom at a spiritual and interior good. Let's unpack this definition. Spiritual goods, in contrast with material goods, are not seen, tasted, or touched. They are goods such as knowledge, virtue, love, and love of a friend. You can see the effects of knowledge, virtue, love, and friendship, but you can't see the knowledge itself or the friendship itself. You can see the friend, but not the friendship. Spiritual goods such as knowledge, virtue, love, and friendship are crucial to human happiness and human flourishing. And spiritual apathy is a disordered avoidance of and sadness at such goods due to a lack of proper love for them. There can be as many sorts of spiritual apathy as there are spiritual goods, but Aquinas focuses on one kind of apathy. Apathy about love for God is the source of human happiness. I'll also discuss apathy about love of others, such as our friends. It is the love of another in the spiritually apathetic person that makes him sad and from which he withdraws. He doesn't care for his own love for the other enough. But how can one be saddened by a spiritual good like love, you may wonder? Don't good things make us feel joy instead of sadness? A person is saddened because the spiritual good is seen as bad in some way. It's seen as an impediment to or getting in the way of another lesser good. For example, if I'm apathetic about my love for a friend, I may see what that love requires getting in the way of my own comfort. The apathetic person is saddened because she thinks the spiritual good imposes a burden on her. For example, love for a spouse requires commitment and willingness to change. If she doesn't love her spouse enough, then that commitment and change will be burdensome and so bring a certain sadness or even resentment to her. The apathetic are saddened by the good primarily due to a lack of love of it, and not simply because they're averse to the work it requires. They fail to cultivate love as they ought. When Aquinas speaks of sadness, he has in mind more than just the emotion of sadness. Sadness also refers to a willed withdrawing from something. It manifests itself as a desire and choice to avoid what love requires. This choice to withdraw from the spiritual good of love, or the choice not to foster that love, are choices for which I'm responsible and contribute to the emotions of sadness we've been discussing. What are some of the bad effects of spiritual apathy? Spiritual apathy is unreasonable because I'm failing to do what love or duty requires and treating something less important as more important than it really is. For example, suppose my love for a friend requires sacrifice. Suppose I'm comfortable and doing something pleasant, but my friend calls and really needs my help. Suppose there isn't a good reason for me not to help. What's holding me back is that I don't want to sacrifice my comfort. I'm apathetic if I fail to love my friend by sacrificing my pleasure and comfort for him. The love for my friend was the interior spiritual good I was avoiding by refusing to help him. Even if I do help, spiritual apathy can make me sluggish to do what love requires. And clearly this is not conducive to my becoming a good friend. Aristotle says that humans cannot stay long in a state of happiness. Since apathy makes us sad, we will either withdraw from that which makes us sad, or distract ourselves from thinking about it with something pleasant. These two responses are manifested by both laziness and busyness. We usually associate spiritual apathy with laziness, with giving up in despair and doing nothing. You imagine the slow-moving sloth and the couch potato as the paradigmatic spiritually apathetic person. But we can also seek to escape the sources of our happiness by distracting ourselves with many activities. We can rush about doing many things and feel some measure of satisfaction at our supposed productivity. But this only avoids the issue we should face and increases our apathy. Good friendships persist because the friends are willing to face hard things it sometimes requires. Our avoidance behaviors can make spiritual apathy a gateway vice to other vices, like greed, gluttony, and lust. Why those vices? Because they all involve things we find very pleasant: money, food, and sex. And we seek pleasure as a remedy for sadness. If by my apathetic behavior I avoid spiritual goods, like my friendships with God and others, because they require that I make some sacrifice, and I instead seek pleasure to diminish my sadness, I'll find over time that even the pleasures I seek as an escape become diminished. And that is because I'm using the pleasant thing to escape, rather than simply enjoying it. For example, I enjoy reading a work of literature much more when I know I can responsibly read it, rather than when I'm reading it to avoid doing something I know I ought to do instead. I want to make a qualification at this point. Sometimes there are actions that love requires that we set aside for a time because we don't have the energy or other resources needed to address them well. That's not apathy, but good sense. It's reasonable to wait for the right time to face difficult things and not necessarily just rush into it. In sum, spiritual apathy is particularly damaging to friendships because if I avoid what love requires, I become resistant to making sacrifice and to changing, which good friendships require. I can even become angry at those who call me to do good because that reminder renews my sadness. How can I avoid spiritual apathy or work against it? De Young, following a 4th century monk named Evagrius, and we could include the Benedictine tradition of monasticism, recommends practicing stabilitas loci, or stability of place. This means that I stay put. I don't try to escape. I face the issue that's causing my sadness, and I resolve it to the best of my ability. It is very easy today to escape. We have a highly mobile society and an almost infinite number of amusements available at our fingertips through our devices. Sometimes it's reasonable to move on, but we should resist doing so when we're really running from what love calls us to do. This requires perseverance, which is another remedy for apathy. Evagrius writes that perseverance is the cure for acadia, Greek for apathy, along with the execution of all tasks with great attention. It's not enough to stay put. A person must stay the course and resolutely attend to the tasks that will foster the love that is lacking. The last vice we'll examine is envy. What is envy? Aquinas defines envy as sadness at another's good, insofar as the good of another is seen as an impediment to one's own excellence. Let's unpack this definition. Sadness here, like in spiritual apathy, can refer to two different things. On the one hand, it can refer to a deliberate withdrawing from willing someone's good. On the other hand, sadness can refer to emotional distress. How can we be sad over another's good? In the case of envy, the truly good thing that causes sadness is perceived to be something bad. We are distressed when we perceive that someone else is getting some good thing, diminishes our own excellence. Because we treat the other's good as something that takes away our own good, we treat what is good for them as bad for us. Hence, in envy, the other's good makes me sad. Consider an example. Suppose my friend gets a better grade than me on a test, and I feel saddened at her having gotten that grade. I begin to wish she hadn't got that grade, but instead that she had got a lower grade than me. That's envy. What's going on? I'm upset because she got a higher grade than me. Perhaps her getting the grade makes me feel inferior to her. Perhaps I just really wanted to be the top of the class and she beat me to it. Either way, her higher score is the source of my distress, and so I began to wish that she had never got that grade, even though it was good for her to do so. The genuine good of another, her success, accomplishments, maturation, etc., contributes to her happiness, and if I love her, or at least have basic goodwill towards her, I should rejoice in her good, or at least not be pained by it, and wish she didn't have it. But envy is contrary to this goodwill. When I envy another person, I withdraw from her good, rather than willing it. I am pained and distressed by her having the good, and I wish she didn't have it. Before unpacking negative effects of this distress, it's worth distinguishing envy from something that is good, but that seems like envy. Suppose a friend works hard over the summer and saves up enough money to go on a trip. He posts his adventures on Facebook, and when I see them, I have a mixed reaction. On the one hand, I'm glad for him to have had the trip, but on the other, I also feel sad that I haven't been on such a trip myself. Is this envy? Perhaps not. Aquinas, following Aristotle, distinguishes envy from something that looks like it, called zeal. Aquinas writes that zeal is when persons are saddened at the fact that they themselves do not have good things that their neighbors do, that their neighbor does. The zealous person then seeks to imitate the other so that they too can attain the good. So, I may work hard to save up so that I can go on a trip like my friend. Zeal is different from envy, for the envious person is saddened at the fact that their neighbor has good things that they themselves do not have. That difference is subtle. Zeal is sadness that I lack a good another has without sadness that the other has it. In contrast, the envious is glad if the other loses the good. Envy involves sadness at the other having it. Zeal is consistent with loving the other and willing them to have the good. Envy is inconsistent with loving the other and wishes them not to have it. What are some bad effects of envy? Basic goodwill or benevolence toward others requires that we will their good. It's a failure of benevolence to respond negatively to the real good of another, but that's exactly what happens in envy. For those who have played sports, think of when you were young and you were taught good sportsmanship. I recall at the end of matches going out to shake the hands of the opposing team and telling them good game. The poor sport was one who sulked and fumed over a loss and wouldn't shake hands with the other team. The poor sport refused to will the good of the other. The poor sport was in the grip of envy. Envy makes it harder to love the friend you envy and harder to be a good friend. It's difficult to be around people who are sources of sadness to us. And it's difficult to have a friendship that's marked by a need to be superior to your friend. Envy also begets offspring, such as gossip and detraction. The envious may attempt to tear down the envied and show she is not as good as others think. The envious gossips when he disparages the one he envies in a secret or disguised way. He tears them down openly by detraction. The envious does this because he thinks tearing down the other will remedy his sadness. Unfortunately, envy often doesn't stop there. It can degenerate into hate for the other person. To hate the other is to wish for the other's misfortune absolutely. For example, envy may start in an athlete because someone else fairly beats him for a starting spot on the team. Hate results when he not only wishes that the other wouldn't have that spot, but when he wishes that bad things would happen to the other person altogether. This leads the envier to exult or rejoice at the other's adversity, say if the other seems to get a serious injury or something really bad happens to him, or to distress if the envied person prospers, say a further examination by the doctor reveals the injury isn't serious, or if something really good happens to him. The hateful person is worse than the envious because they are totally set against the other rather than just in one way. How can I avoid envy or work against it? Envy stems from a comparative sense of self-value and self-esteem. To combat envy, we have to disconnect self-value and self-esteem from a winning comparison with others. A comparative sense of self-value is easy to come by in our culture. We sometimes don't have a clear sense for what gives us value. So we can take false consolation in the thought that at least we're better than the next guy. A more robust sense of self-value will depend on one's own intrinsic value stemming from one's nature, from the unique traits and gifts one has received, and from being loved by God. A second remedy is to pay attention to and cultivate concern for the goods we share with others rather than competitive goods. I can't envy a person if her having a good doesn't diminish my having it too. My friend coming to know something that I know doesn't take my knowledge away from me at all, and we can rejoice together in having the knowledge. Finally, practice good zeal. Focus on what you can do to become better, and try to love the one you envy and imitate her so that you can be worthy of the good that she has. In conclusion, my goal for this talk was to help you to understand and avoid the capital vices of vainglory, spiritual apathy, and envy, and the unhappiness they produce. The mere avoidance of these vices is insufficient for happiness, but it's a step toward happiness. We've looked at some ways that they impede or undermine human flourishing and hinder our ability to have good friendships. Understanding these vices, their bad effects on us, and some of their remedies will, if we make use of the knowledge and the aid of our friends, help us to avoid being unhappy and so remove obstacles to our search for happiness. Thank you. For your questions. Yeah?
I have a few questions. One of them was if being happy requires friendship, then do you believe that it is required for God to have creation to have friendship with in order to be happy?
No, I do not. You know, what's beautiful about the doctrine of the Trinity is that the persons of the Trinity exist in eternal friendship of love. And so God does not need creation for friendship. He has it within himself. Do you have another one?
Yes, sir. Sorry.
Yeah.
This one was about envy. Are you guilty of envy if you're being loyal to a family member to succeed over someone who's not family? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I guess we would have to know more about the case, right? So suppose my dad goes to a job interview and he doesn't get the job and someone else gets it and I'm really sad that he didn't get the job. That might not be envy. And in a way, because it's a competitive situation, you sort of wish that he had gotten it and so that the other person didn't get it. But I think you can... the sort of mark of envy is that you really want it taken from the other, even if they deserved it. And that you really... And that it can bleed over into sort of some of the other things I talked about, where you wish bad things happened to them, you stew over it. It's a very counterproductive emotion, envy is. It doesn't yield a lot of fruit, whereas I think you wouldn't need to have that in the case. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so when you're talking about spiritual apathy, one of the things that you turn to in sadness is pleasure. And I know Aquinas also says that one of his remedies of sadness is pleasure.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's the difference between good and what's good?
It's natural to turn to pleasant things when you're sad. I'm not claiming that all turning to pleasant things when sad is a bad thing, right? It can be very wise. The problem is that we can also turn to pleasant things when we're sad in unreasonable ways too. So if I'm procrastinating, or if I'm failing to do something love requires in a relationship, and I'm avoiding those things, and I'm seeking remedy for the sadness, the problem is not that I'm seeking actually to address the heart of the sadness, right? That would be different. So if I, there's a relational tension, it has to be addressed. if I'm trying to resolve the sadness in that way, then I'm being reasonable. I'm actually trying to, as it were, resolve the problem. Whereas if I'm escaping from it and seeking the pleasure, then that's what makes it unreasonable. But it's not unreasonable to restore yourself, as it were, to recover your energies by doing things that are pleasant to you, right? We all need that. And so it's not, if you're tired at the end of the day and you can no longer think very clearly and you're not really in a position to be able to think through the tough relational issue you've got to solve, then seeking some amusement or seeking some rest would be reasonable. The problem is when I've got, you know, I'm lucid, I've got lots of energy, I'm not worn out, and I know this is what I should do, but I don't want to do it because I don't care enough about it. I haven't fostered the care for it, and then I seek to escape into the pleasure.